You're listening to Bill Padley on Let's Talk. Now, Mike Rinder was a chief spokesman of the Church of Scientology, served as executive director at the Office of Special Affairs, and was a director of the Church of Scientology International. But after becoming dissatisfied with how he believed the church was propagating Scientology and believing they'd become excessively authoritarian, he left the church in 2007, instead becoming an independent Scientologist. I'm delighted that Mike Rinder joins us on the show now. Good morning to you, Mike.
Good morning, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's a story we've talked about before on the show. I was just explaining to you before there, we've had John Sweeney on, a man you're very familiar with.
Oh, yes, I am. He's become a good friend. I consider him one of the bravest journalists I've ever met.
Well, I'm sure he'd take that as a great compliment, and we'll get on to John's part in your life in just a moment, because it is a very important part in your life, bizarrely, isn't it?
Yes, it is. As the spokesperson for the church, I was the person who was designated to deal with John when he was working on a panorama program about Scientology, and John confronted me with the allegations about David Miscavige, who was the leader of the church, having violently assaulted individuals, which I, as the spokesperson, felt that I had to deny. And then he very pointedly said, well, I've been told by a number of people that David Miscavige has physically assaulted you, which was accurate and true, and I had to deny it, and that was really the last act that I participated in within the Church of Scientology, because having to publicly state that no such thing was going on when I knew that it was a position I was unwilling to remain in, and that was when I actually left the church.
Amazing. Let's go back a few years for people that don't know your story, Mike, because it is a fascinating one. Your parents, I believe, firstly became interested in Scientology because L. Ron Hubbard had given lectures in Melbourne around kind of 1960 time.
Yes, that's exactly right. I was raised in a Scientology family. My parents became Scientologists in the very early 1960s, and so I grew up with Scientology as a part of my life. And something that I think is important, Bill, is there is a distinction between the subject or philosophy of Scientology and the activities of the Church of Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really equate them at all. I believe that the Church of Scientology has departed dramatically and radically from the fundamental principles of Scientology. There are things that I disagree with about the subject of Scientology too, but I believe that there is also a lot contained within Scientology that is good and beneficial and helps a lot of people. The church, on the other hand, has become a very authoritarian, money-grubbing, controlling organization, and really is giving a bad name to the subject of Scientology.
That's interesting. We'll get into more detail on that as we get through a bit. You finished high school, and I believe you joined something called the Sea Org at 18. What was the Sea Org?
The Sea Org was and still is the central, you know, probably the easiest analogy to make, Bill, is to the priesthood of the Catholic Church, or even the Vatican, in that the highest levels of Scientology organization and the most devoted and trusted members of the religion are all what's called Sea Organization members. And Sea Org simply comes from the fact that at the time, the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, was living aboard a ship in the Mediterranean, and that was Sea Organization, part of the Church of Scientology, and the name and some of those traditions have sort of stuck. But it's those people who devote themselves 24/7, 365 days a year to forwarding the aims of the church, to live in church facilities, eat communally, and really entire life is devoted to the church.
I get it. Now, rather fascinatingly, you mentioned there that this boat was based in the Mediterranean. In fact, you ended up working for this ship, the yacht Apollo, in one of my favorite places in the world. In fact, not far from where we are now, Funchal in Madeira.
Yes, that's right. Bill, I was, you know, the ship was in Portugal a lot and some in Spain and in the Azores and Canaries and Madeira. And in fact, there was a shore outpost, a shore-based outpost of the ship that was set up in Funchal to do surveys, tourism surveys for the Portuguese government. It's a bit of a long story that's not really relevant to anything in today's world, but for about 9 months, I lived in Funchal. In fact, it was up until the April Revolution in, I guess it was 1974, and at which point, somewhat shortly thereafter, that activity was abandoned, and in fact the Apollo moved to the Caribbean rather than the Mediterranean.
You were sent to that ship for executive training with Hubbard himself. Now, for people who know that name but they don't know the man like you would have known him, tell us about Hubbard.
Well, L. Ron Hubbard is the founder of Scientology. He's also well known as a writer of science fiction. I spent a good deal of time with him. He is a larger than life personality. Everything about him was larger than life. He was a big man. He had a big sense of humor. He had a voracious appetite for knowledge. He put together the subjects of Dianetics and Scientology. And in many respects, a lot of what is contained in Dianetics and Scientology is synthesized or distilled from many, many other things through history. You know, thinking men through history have all pondered the same question, and Hubbard came up with a kind of a distillation of a lot of the knowledge that had gone before, and also methods that he developed for how to improve one's own condition, one's understanding of himself and others. And he was a very, very interesting person. He was the most widely read, knowledgeable person on the most vast and bizarre array of subjects that I have ever met. I mean, he would sit and talk about all sorts of things and had an immense intelligence and ability to absorb information, and read dozens, hundreds, thousands of books, and was constantly looking for knowledge and information. And he was a very interesting man. He was, you know, one of those people who walks into a room, and whether he says anything or not, everybody notices that he just walked into the room.
And I'm guessing as a young man of 18, 19, that was quite a figure to be around.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely was. And certainly for someone who had been raised a Scientologist, I mean, this is the closest, L. Ron Hubbard is the closest thing that you get to the traditional religious figure in any religion. I mean, it's Joseph Smith for the Mormons, it's Muhammad for Islamists, it's, you know, Jesus for the Christians. Every religion has some form of prophet or person who is the founder of the faith, and that was L. Ron Hubbard. So he was certainly someone to be in the minds of a Scientologist. He was the the most important person on planet Earth.
Yeah, I can understand. So there you are then, this young man, you're 19, you're in Funchal, Madeira. Things start to take a little bit of an odd turn. The locals start to dump cars and motorbikes owned by you into the water. They throw rocks at the ship, and eventually you need a military escort to get back to the ship and get out of there.
Yes, that was one of the more harrowing nights of my life. Spent holed up being protected by the Portuguese army, and I had no idea what was really going to happen. I didn't know if the ship had sailed away or what. This was all based on, you know, after the revolution, the very right-wing government was replaced by a left-wing government in Portugal, and the rumors started being spread that the Apollo, the ship that we were on, was a CIA ship, and the CIA had become horribly unpopular at that time in Portugal. And so, Funchal, if you've been there, I love the place, but
beautiful
there
place,
isn't much to do. And everybody sits around in the cafes and, you know, drinks beer and coffee, and there just isn't much happening. So it was like having a bullfight or something show up in town.
I can imagine. So eventually you end up, after you say sailing in the Caribbean for a while, you move the operations to land and you took over the downtown area of Clearwater in Florida. Though bizarrely, the kind of spiritual home of the church was St. Hill Manor in England. Being from England and knowing where that place is, it's not somewhere I would set up something that huge, but there we go.
Well, that was a function of the fact that Hubbard bought St. Hill Manor there in 1959 as his home.
Ah.
And it grew from being literally his home. He and his family lived at St. Hill Manor, and then some students of Scientology started coming from around the world, and eventually it became a destination for Scientologists to come to where L. Ron Hubbard was. And so then there was sort of church facilities established there. But it didn't start out being church headquarters. It started out being a home for L. Ron Hubbard and his family.
Understood. So back to the story. You're in Clearwater and a major part of the church there. And then after several years, things start to look like they're not going right for you. And having looked at this, I'd never heard of this part of your life until I did the research. Something called the hole came into it. Tell us about the hole.
Well, that was that was after 2004, thereabouts. David Miscavige, who had assumed control of the church subsequent to the death of L. Ron Hubbard in 1986, there is a big church facility outside of Los Angeles called Golden Era Productions. And at Golden Era Productions is also the highest levels of church management. If there is anything that is the equivalent of the Vatican for the Church of Scientology, it is that facility in California.
Okay.
And Miscavige he has a very volatile temper and believes that, well, let me put it this way, Bill. He has a sociopathic personality.
Okay.
And he is constantly trying to figure out how to control and dominate people around him and keep everybody at bay who could possibly threaten his position or his authority or whatever. So at some point he decided that a number of people were doing him such harm by reason of their incompetence that they deserved to be locked up in a room and not come out until they had figured out what was wrong with themselves. And that was the start of what became known as the Hole.
How did Miscavige get himself into that position after Hubbard's death? What was the procedure that happened that made him the kind of big boss, effectively?
Well, this is a very, very long story that we could spend a few hours talking about.
Okay.
But let me say that Miscavige had manipulated himself into a position prior to Hubbard's death of being the person who controlled all communications to and from Hubbard, and therefore was able to inform Hubbard of things and keep the flow of information oriented toward his brilliance, meaning Miscavige's brilliance. Everything that got forwarded to Hubbard in some way or another was about the virtues or made clear that Miscavige was doing a wonderful job and he was very virtuous and he was handling everything, etc., etc. And so he managed to get for himself a lot of credit from Hubbard about his skill and his abilities and his dedication to the well-being of Scientology, and he parlayed that into effectively getting rid of anybody else who could be a potential rival to him subsequent to that time. I mean, I have shorthanded that horribly, but that really is what happened.
Was Miscavige the kind of guy that you personally instantly saw that in, or did that come over a period of time?
No. It came over a period of time. He, you know, like many sociopaths, he is a charming, or can be charming, and can be very convincing, and appears to be doing good, and certainly makes it very clear to everybody that is around him or near him or hears of him what a wonderful guy he is.
Mm.
The you know, disclosing or seeing what really goes on behind the scenes and what his actual intention is a little harder to grasp, but it takes some time. And you know, there is a very interesting book written by a psychologist called Martha Stout, called The Sociopath Next Door. And she studied for 40 years people that are sociopaths and what effect they have on people and why people around them don't really recognize the scope of the nastiness of these people and how they manage to manipulate others. You know, it's people that don't have a conscience, and when they're dealing with people who do have a conscience, which is the vast majority of people with a conscience cannot possibly, they cannot comprehend or believe that the acts of a sociopath are in fact what they are. They find reasons to explain them. They find reasons, they can't contemplate themselves doing or acting like they're seeing, so they believe that it's not really what's going on.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to get to the point of recognition of just how out of control someone might be, like who is a sociopath.
Mm. You're just one of a few former executives to go public in the last few years with stories of abuse at the hands of Miscavige. What do you think that you had supposedly done wrong personally that brought the wrath of him down upon you then?
The final straw, I mean, there were many things. I was always in trouble in his mind, but the final straw was the BBC Panorama show. And though at the time John Sweeney and BBC, actually not John Sweeney, but the BBC, chose not to air the allegations that Miscavige had been physically assaulting people, this wasn't good enough for Miscavige, and he thought that I had failed him terribly and failed everybody terribly because the show aired at all. And thus, I was then, you know, he said that I was then to go to St. Hill, you know, in East Grinstead, because I was in London at the time dealing with the BBC, and dig ditches.
Wow.
And that I was just to become a permanent ditch digger at St. Hill, not even to return to the United States. And at that point, I went, you know what? This is a hopeless and thankless task. I'm never getting anywhere, and I walked away.
We're in conversation with Mike Rinder on Let's Talk, and you can hear the next part of the interview at 11:30 right here on Talk Radio Europe.